Read your piece in the Daily Mail, the 26th of October, on the Battle of Agincourt. I was absolutely disgusted at the inference that it did not occur, as has originally been reported. So wrote a retired wing commander to me shortly after a newspaper article published last autumn. Since accuracy is a duty of the historian, I need to point out straight away that it was not my piece in the Daily Mail. I wouldn't be here if I was writing for the Daily Mail, but one which that newspaper had summarised from a long article in the New York Times, published on the anniversary of the Battle of Agincourt on the 25th of October 2009. A study of modern newspapers is a salutary experience for the medieval historian. Travelling down from Southampton to Reading, as I do most days, I regularly read the free newspaper, The Metro, and probably quite a few of you have read it today. When I get home in the evening, I read the copy of the Daily Telegraph, which had been delivered earlier in the day, but after my departure for work. By the way, it's not because of my political leanings, it's entirely because of its excellent cricket coverage. I do come from Chesterley Street, and Collingwood is clearly the greatest hero ever. There is also, always, I think, in these newspaper readings, a sense of déjà vu. When I come home in the evening and read the Telegraph, I've read all of the news items already, because newspapers nowadays rely on press agencies for much of their copy, which they recycle, sometimes with minor changes of emphasis. If you don't believe me, look at a set of newspapers for the same day, and you'll see what I mean. Now, the historian is only as good as his or her sources. But in these newspapers of today, do we have one source, because it's all coming from the same source, or many? There's a strong parallel for me with medieval chronicles, narrative accounts on which many have relied for their study of the period, but which are highly dangerous when used uncritically, as they're all too often are by popular writers. There are many books on the Crusades which are based on rather dubious narrative chronicle sources without any criticism whatsoever. Now, sometimes medieval chroniclers dealing with an incident agree, and that's not surprising because, like today's newspapers, they often simply copied from each other. I hope your students don't do that. I think university students are getting better, but that's the great white heat of technology and systems like Turnitin that make it much more difficult. Classic examples of what I'm meaning are three French chronicles which are often cited in connection with the Battle of Agincourt, Enguerrand Monstrelet, Jean de Warlin, and Jean Lefebvre, which are virtually identical, word for word. Monstrelet seems to have been the earliest and the original, written in the 1440s, already, of course, 25 years after the event. Yet it was Warin and Lefebvre who were present at the battle. Warin claimed he was 15 at the time of the battle, fighting on the French side, and Jean Lefebvre was 19 and was with the heralds. Indeed, they insert into their text a mention of this, but otherwise they are identical to each other. These works, then, are problematic. Did Monstrelet draw up his account based on oral information which he got from the other two, but later on they wrote up their own account from which they used his version? Did Monstrelet write independently, with the others simply using his text later and adding in personal reminiscences? Why did they add virtually the same thing? Did Warin copy Lefebvre, or did Lefebvre copy Warin? We don't know. But I hope you'll recognise in this a perennial problem for the historian, and no doubt one which A-level students are made constantly aware by those teachers of you in the audience. Primary sources are problematic and need critical examination. Now, in the case with which I began my talk, the original source was the New York Times, where there was a long article on Agincourt written by James Glance. Where had he got his information from? No doubt he'd read some published work on the Battle of Agincourt, but I can't know what he'd read. This is always an issue with our chroniclers, because we don't know what they'd read, which might have influenced them. Though in one instance, relating to the Battle of Agincourt, we do know something, and this is the account written by Thomas Walsingham, a monk of the Benedictine Monastery of St. Albans, just to the north of London. And we can see that in his account he knew some classical texts because he cited choice phrases from them, and I've put these on the slide. Golden are the chains that hang drooping from their breasts. That's the French cavalry coming towards the English. Inspired by the same motive, bad typing there, his spelling was better than mine, did each of the armies rush forward. That's when the battle starts. Born on high on horseback, he goes round the columns, encouraging his leaders and strengthening their resolve for battle. That's Henry V. But as you can see, none of these are original to the Battle of Agincourt. They are all drawn from classical texts, and they put in, perhaps to make it equivalent to an epic of the past, or perhaps because, frankly, Thomas Walsingham, a monk of St. Albans, knew, I will say, bugger all about what had happened at the Battle of Agincourt. A bit like some newspapers, I feel. Now, we have a good parallel here, I think. The newspapers of today seem to know better what is in the minds of politicians than politicians themselves. The headline, which doesn't then really meet or fit with what follows, today's Metro headline is, Coalition is on the ropes on day one. Well, I don't think all newspapers are saying that, incidentally. Now, it's dubious that Walsingham had actually read all of these Latin works from which he cites. It's a bit like A-level source extracts here. What he did was take them from a florilegium, which was a collection of choice quotes of this type from which you could kind of rent a quote, almost. And we know there's a florilegium in the library at St. Albans, whereas we don't know that there were copies of some of these other texts. So I think we have an interesting issue here about the origin of sources, the danger of taking short passages out of context. And I know there's quite a debate about this in A-level, as indeed there is at university, where we have the third year special subject. Many of you will have taken that, where you've used source materials. Do you just get huge sources to read, so you haven't a clue what's going to come up in the exam, or do you get a book of extracts already dissected, if you like, that then reappear on the exam paper? We have exactly the same problems here, because it's the art of the possible, what can be done in the time available. Now, to return to the New York Times journalist, James Glanz, I know that he'd relied on oral testimony because he'd phoned me up. He'd phoned me up on numerous occasions, and if any of you have had dealings with the press in this kind of thing, you'll know this is exactly what happens. I've been involved in the Bosworth Project recently at a big event on the 20th of February to reveal the findings of gunshot on a new battlefield site. And I was rung up by David Keyes of The Independent on many, many occasions, right to the wire of getting his article in. And then so I eagerly, at the service station on the way to the event in Leicester, I eagerly bought The Independent, not very good for cricket coverage. And I discovered to my horror there was nothing at all in there of what I'd spoken about. In fact, worse than that, there was nothing at all about the Battle of Bosworth. His article wasn't there. And that's because, he contacted me later, to say that those naughty Leicester County Council people had done a privilege deal with the Times, and therefore the Times had it earlier than the Independent, and therefore they weren't going to run a second-hand article. So that, of course, undermines my comment at the beginning that the newspapers all copy from each other. There is a sort of problem there in the competitiveness between them. But as I say, Glanz had got, like Keyes, oral testimony from me. And the chroniclers did so as well. But the problem, of course, is knowing where their information came from. Who was it they spoke to? Thomas Walsingham at St. Albans must have talked to some people, but we haven't a clue who passed through St. Albans and gave him the evidence. Did he get it first-hand or second-hand? We don't know this. And therefore, reliability is as much an issue as when these chroniclers make things up themselves. It's also tied up with the nature of rhetoric in the medieval period. Clearly those Walsingham quotes are a very good example of that. He was going to show off that he knew these classical sources, but the whole method of writing in the Middle Ages was for effect, particularly Latin writers, and therefore it's quite difficult for us to reconstruct events from things because they are written about in a certain kind of way. there that we've got to be kind of aware of. We've got to understand then these chronicles as a genre as much as we need to appreciate where journalists are coming from and going to. Why then do people write as they do? And of course the crucial thing here is that fact and opinion can become confused. And that was the problem for my wing commander. The fact of the Battle of Agincourt, and I'll come back to the problems of that in a minute, were confused in his mind with his opinion about the battle. Now, James Glance's article in the New York Times had showed that he'd interviewed others, Bertrand Schnerb in Lille, Michael Prestwich in Durham, Clifford Rogers at West Point in America, and some others. So he'd assembled, if you like, the views of historians, rather like, again, an A-level syllabus might wish to do. I have a particular take on the Battle of Agincourt, as some of you will know, especially those who are from branches where I've given a talk on the battle. My basic argument is that the English army was larger than that cited in the popular works on the battle, and that the French army was smaller. My argument here is based on close examination of the administrative records of both armies. I've only got slides, unfortunately, of the English army, but there is documentary material on the French army. Other historians seem to deny its existence, but it is out there. It's also based on what I know over many years of study of late medieval military organisation in general, and indeed that is why I know that the French could not have had an army of 160,000 people, or even of 40,000. There was a civil war going on at the time, so an army of 14,000 is the largest we know of for definite, should have been raised in around 1412. What I'm saying here then is we've got two issues. We've got the sources we need to look at, but we also need to look at the context in which the events are happening, my knowledge then of the late medieval military context. Now, not every late medieval historian has agreed with me. In fact, I had quite a good battle with Clifford Rogers at the Kalamazoo Medieval Congress the other year. But essentially what we have here, I think, is a battle of the sources. Chronicles versus governmental records. And here we have a governmental record, the muster of Sir Thomas Erpingham with his troops on the heath at Southampton, probably very near to where my office is now, taken in early July 1415 before the army set out. And so we can know who was with Sir Thomas. And we can see in the middle there, as a group of four bracketed together, Sir Thomas was so famous he was able to take another four people, as on their ultra le nombre. They were not paid. They were there and was waiting for the others to die so that they could get a job as a man-at-arms or an archer in that retinue. This one here is presented after the campaign, along with the account, because all these soldiers are paid, and that's why we know so much about them. And it shows that of those men on the previous slide, some of them were unfortunate enough to take ill at the siege of Harfleur, some died, some had gone home, some were put into the garrison at Harfleur when they moved off towards Calais, but others were at the battle itself. And so we have a dynamic view here. Really a lot of information then in this kind of material, including, think on this one, the poor man who was killed on the 24th of October, the day before the battle, like those who die in the First World War, you know, the day before the armistice. That sort of thing has a long pedigree. And the battle is with printed sources, particularly those printed in the early 19th century by Harris Nicholas in his History of the Battle of Agincourt. There, you can see, which was taken from a manuscript in the British Library, Harleian 782, which was, in fact, itself drawn up in the early 17th century. So it is not a medieval text at all. So we've got a 19th century text printed based on an early 17th century text in manuscript. We don't know where that was copied from, so we've got to look at the genealogy, if you like, of that document. It is, however, very well known. Now, you've got Sir Thomas Erpingham there, and all of these additional things in steward of the king's house with his retinue. That's a 17th century comment. It's not a medieval comment. I know that from the way things are described, if you like, in documents of the time. Some of those names are the same as on the first document I showed you, but there aren't really enough of them. He actually had 30 men-at-arms with him. Where are the rest? And even worse than that, this person hasn't even bothered to list the archers. It just gives a number for them. And this led many people to say, we do not know the names of the archers at Agincourt. That's because we're relying entirely on this printed material in the edition by Harris Nicholas. Now, Harris Nicholas also was the first to try to draw what happened at the Battle of Agincourt. And by then, of course, the English, or British by then, of course, had to be in red and the French had to be in blue. As you can see, it's a very early 19th century version of events, heavily influenced by Napoleonic warfare. And it would be reasonably credible, I suppose, were it not that Agincourt was actually on the wrong side of the map. The layout is completely wrong. Now, clearly, it's rather like when you print a book, you discover lots of typos that are not your fault, but the fault of the publisher. Perhaps he went mad when he saw this and wanted to kill the printer, though he perhaps didn't have much chance because he had a rather colourful private life, this author, and eventually had to go abroad, kind of say no more. I think women problems in his case rather than the Oscar Wilde issues. But that is the first known attempt to draw a battle plan, which, to be frank, you cannot draw. But slightly earlier, but obviously unknown to Harris Nicholas, is a plan drawn in 1818 by Sir John Woodford. Very interesting, this, because the area in which Agincourt lies was actually occupied by British troops after 1815. Duke of Wellington was present in this area, and Woodford was one of his aides-de-camp, and he carried out the first excavations at the site. It is believed there are some materials still around, a gold coin, various other things that were found on this occasion, and it's the first attempt to locate the battle geographically. However, today's archaeologists don't actually think it was there. I was involved in Battlefield Detectives on Channel 4, and there was a lot of metal detecting and field walking of that area down in the middle there, and not a single arrowhead or anything else was found. The Bosworth problem then, a lot of looking around fields where the battle wasn't, and then eventually, towards the end of the project, finding things on a field they never thought had anything to do with the battle. It is a problem knowing where these are. How large is a medieval battlefield? Very big problem for us, and I can tell you that it is an extremely dangerous thing. On the night before the Leicester event, on the 20th of February, I was phoned up by the president of the Richard III Federation Incorporated, the American branch, the sort of more militant wing of the Richard III Society, and told, was I absolutely sure that this field, in which a substantial number of cannonballs of the right period and a boar badge and various other things had been found, was the site of the Battle of Bosworth, because she had been to another location and she'd seen Richard III, and kind of he told her where it was. So you have got to watch out for those people who have better sources than I have. Now, the matter goes deeper. The wing commander, of course, didn't write to me based on his awareness of these source issues. He probably wasn't even a member of the Historical Association. But because his knowledge came from something which is hard to pin down, but which is kind of out there in the public domain as history, and I think this is something that's going to come up quite a lot in this conference. Do I mean popular history? Perhaps, probably popular views about history, and perhaps myths. Why does this situation arise? Should we be worried about it? Can we? Should we do anything about it? I think there is here a strong link to doing history and the problems of public history and of internet history. The Wikipedia site for the Battle of Agincourt is amended with great regularity. My views were put up by somebody there and were accepted, but gradually more and more of my opponents have been going onto that site. It's probably a good job that I'm not very technologically minded. I can't sort of take it off there and put up my version. Perhaps I should get somebody to do that for me. But what I think we have, and I'm sure this is where my wing commander was coming from, is a popular tradition tied up with patriotism. People do seem to get worked up about certain events in our history, and the battles of Agincourt and Bosworth are very good examples of that. Perhaps there is here a sense of identity in history, but of course that is a very dangerous thing. The Daily Mail, following the launch of my Big Soldier project, on which I'm going to say a bit more in a minute, was very impressed by the database, but wrote almost a BNP version of what it might all mean. These were the days, as it covers 1369 to 1453, so it includes Agincourt, it's basically a listing of soldiers in English service in that period, but they, of course, use the word British because they don't understand the difference that 1603 made, or even 1801, made to our nation. But they came out with this view that this is when the British were truly valiant and truly British and had not been polluted by other nations, if you like. That's why we were able to beat the hell out of Europeans. So there's an anti-Europe stance in this as well. So some very interesting things can come out of the sort of almost rather dull research that historians do, can be reinterpreted in the public domain for a political message. I think we have a particularly selective view of the Middle Ages. And this goes back quite a long way. It began actually in the Tudor period. Perhaps it began first with telling Henry VIII to emulate Henry V. The first English life of Henry V was published in 1513, dedicated to Henry VIII, urging him to go to war with the French, which he actually did do in 1513, but also urging him to be like Henry V and to be loyal to one woman alone. Clearly, Henry VIII did not take up that message. It was also then developed by Edward Hall, the chronicler of the reign of Henry VIII, who wrote a great book published in 1542 called The Union of the Houses of York and Lancaster, which was an attempt to show that things had started to go wrong in 1398 under Richard II, but they were resolved by the Battle of Bosworth in 1483. So it had a particular take on the whole of that century. It got into Holinshed and then into Shakespeare, because if you know the play Richard II, it begins in 1398. With the duel between Bolingbroke and Mowbray. So it's taken directly from that. So it was a rewriting, if you like, of the 15th century. And it was also then developed by things like I talked about, the Harleian 782, this copy of a presumably, or copy of a copy of, presumably some original medieval source of some listing of names at the Battle of Agincourt. We don't know which original it came from. And also, this is done particularly by the heralds in the College of Arms, copies of late medieval military ordinances and things of this sort, but often in rather bad copies. But much of medieval history actually comes from Tudor and Stuart sources, and also from a book published in the 1770s, Gross's Military Antiquities. You look at books on medieval military history, often they don't cite original sources, they cite Gross's medieval antiquities. It's all antiquarianism then here, an interest in genealogy as well. And I think it's important then to know that the reinterpretation of the Middle Ages started not that long after the Middle Ages are deemed to end. The Wing Commander went on to explain why he believed I was wrong. And the reason he gave was because he'd read a plaque at the site of the battlefield that told him that on this very spot, the flower of French chivalry in huge number were defeated by a plucky and small band of English. He'd seen it, and therefore that proved it to him that that is what had happened. Seeing, then, is believing. And I think this is a key element in the popular perception of the Middle Ages. And I want now to show you some slides of how I think this has entered the psyche and is still with us now. Oh, by the way, that's a letter from Woodford about the excavations that he was involved in. There's an exhibition on at the V&A currently of Horace Walpole, who did a lot in the 18th century to reinvent, or perhaps invent, Gothic. And there's a lot of medievalism coming in here. In 1770, Wedgwood produced a series of roundels of British monarchs. This one here is Henry V. And I owe this, I particularly wanted to include this today, because Nancy Edwards, who is connected with the Essex branch of the HA for quite a long time, gave me this picture for my book on the Battle of Agincourt. There is another exhibition currently finishing at the National Gallery, on Paul Delaroche and other early 19th century artists, when historical scenes like this began to be popular. This one here is not by him, it's by Lorimier, and this is Jeanne de Navarre, who became the second wife of Henry IV, and her son Jean V, of Duke of Brittany, and it was painted in 1806. Now, as you can see, it's the Middle Ages are the era of nice dresses. Now, is it quite as nice a dress as the Tudor nice dresses? I have heard people tell me that they like the Tudors because Elizabeth wears nice dresses. So no one's got to factor this in. But the little boy there is definitely in early 19th century clothing. So this is an anachronistic thing. And they're at the tomb of his father. Now, I don't know whether people did that kind of thing quite like that in the Middle Ages. They certainly didn't do this sort of thing. This chap here, going like that, is the mad Charles VI. And behind there is his, I think it's his sister.